never thought it could be this way. I never thought you'd not be here today, no. All that we've done is right before my eyes. Can you understand why this little man cries? Silly memories of you are all that I can cling to. But how can I be true when all that's left of you
shines? Nothing but shadows. I can see shadows
everywhere I turn, everything I do.
Shadows. Ooh, but shadows.
Can't get off.
I can see shadows.
No, they. My life without you is like a song without a rhyme, and you taught me to live and reach for the sky. It's not easy, but you knew I'd try. Everywhere I turn, you're just one step ahead, girl. I wish that I could control these little old tears.
Shadows.
Oh, I can't get over.
I can see the shadows.
KLN. This is Saturday Morning Live. This is CKLN. My name is Norman Richmond, and we are getting ready to speak with Dr. Abdullah Khalidman. Are you there? You're listening to CKLN, and we are experiencing a technical glitch, and we will be right
back.
See them everywhere. When I'm sitting in my chair, driving in my car, going near, going far,
I can see shadows.
I don't know how, but some way I'll get.
And you're listening to CKLN, GC Cameron, former spinner, former Temptation in the background. He's saying Shadows. And joining me on the line is Dr. Abdul Al-Kalimat of University of Illinois, correct? You're listening to CKLN, and we are having major technical issues, and we're getting ready to get Abdul Al-Kalimat back on the phone. And this is Saturday Morning Live. We are on CKLN.FM, CKLN.FM. So call your friends, neighbors, enemies, and let them know that we are still here. If they have access to the internet, they can hear us on www.ckln.fm. And 88.1 is history for now, and we are going to attempt to get Abdul Al-Kalimat. We're going to be speaking about Manny Marable's book and Abdul Al-Kalimat's work around Malcolm X. This is Saturday Morning Live, and we are going to have Abdul Al-Kalimat right now. How are you doing, Abdul?
Oh, I'm doing good. Good to be back.
You're at the University of Illinois, Champaign, Illinois?
Yes, Champaign-Urbana.
Champaign-Urbana. Okay, now, I guess we wanted to talk about a number of... I wanted to talk about the Manning Marable's book, Reinvention, but before we talk about that, really wanted to let people know some of the work that you have been doing around Malcolm X. I met you in 1990. You put on the Malcolm X conference in New York City, and you had almost 1,000 people from how many, 26, was it 26 countries? And
yes, more than 1,000.
More than 1,000 people? Go ahead.
What was really special about this conference was that it was the last time Alex Haley, Betty Shabazz, C. Eric Lincoln, Margaret Burroughs, who along with Dudley Randall had published that first collection of poetry about Malcolm, and so all of these elders were able to come together along with Betty Shabazz, and then all of the activists that particularly on the East Coast, that had been really the legacy of Malcolm. And so it really was a way of saying that Malcolm had never been forgotten. And this was a celebration not only of what Malcolm had accomplished in his life, but the legacy of Malcolm, which continues to, of course, live today.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of since that time, you have put together a BrotherMalcolm.net, and I think you did a book on Malcolm X for Beginners. That was a I don't know if you want to talk about that experience, but talk about some of the other projects, BrotherMalcolm.net, and some of the other projects that you have been involved with to keep Malcolm X's legacy alive.
Well, one of the things that we did was to form what we call the Malcolm X Work Group. And in this group, particularly, was Preston Wilcox,
right,
who established what he called the Malcolm X Lovers Network. And he had been an archivist, a community-based archivist in Harlem. And his collection of flyers, of notices, newspaper articles, really demonstrates the continuity of how Malcolm continued to live in the minds and hearts of the people of Harlem. But also, Bill Sayles, whose dissertation was on Malcolm X and the OAAU, and that was, of course, published as a book. And also there was James Cone, was at Union Theological Seminary, and he published his book on Malcolm and Martin, meaning Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. And then, of course, I was involved relative to that came out in terms of the website and other writings. But this really was a major activity because we worked collectively. We shared each other's work. We critiqued each other's work. And in that way, everyone's work was very much better. And I, for the young people who are listening, this is a real lesson to always work both intellectually and politically with a group of people that you share a common interest with. And on that basis, we can continue to rebuild and our movement will remain alive.
Mm-hmm. Do you care to talk about the Malcolm X for Beginners project?
Certainly. We published a study guide, which was printed with newsprint paper and given away free in building up toward the 1990 conference that you referenced. People who were with Writers and Readers Press approached me to republish this study guide that we had given away free as one of the For Beginners series, which, of course, we agreed and assumed that the relatively brief quotes that we were using from published work would fit under the copyright principle of fair use. And as it turned out, the Pathfinder Press, who had been making most of its money on publishing Fidel and Che, and of course Malcolm, they approached Betty Shabazz and convinced her that what we were doing was hurting their financial interests and therefore her financial interests. And they filed a suit.
Mm-hmm.
And we basically pulled the book off the market because, in fact, there was very little money involved. And I got, just for the record, absolutely no income from that project.
Right.
On the other hand, Betty Shabazz and I, along with Bill Sales, built up a very positive relationship, and we have a videotape that is, in fact, on our website where Betty Shabazz is speaking at a Malcolm X work group session where she introduces me as the director of the planned Malik Shabazz Institute. In other words, we had planned to work together on research and policy matters. And, of course, for various many reasons, that never took place, but it does indicate that the Pathfinder Press move that pulled Betty into attacking through this lawsuit was not the substantial relationship, because in fact we were able to reunite and begin to work on other projects.
Well, Betty Shabazz was in Uganda in 1994. You were there, and I think Walter Rodney's wife and Patrice Lumumba's daughters and sons were there, and
yep.
Betty Shabazz was there too. If I am correct, I know she was there.
That's right.
Yeah. And So that basically, so you and Sister Betty had a relationship. It wasn't all gloom and doom then. And
oh, absolutely not.
Now the situation with the people that Malcolm influenced are many. One of the people that he influenced was Gil Scott Heron. Yes. And I know that you were born in Chicago, which is the birthplace of Gil Scott Heron. I was just looking at some of the people that were born in Chicago. George Jackson, Ricky Henderson, Boots Riley, Gil Scott Heron. I mean, there's a lot of people, they were born there and they left. But I would like to get your thoughts on, you know, the passing of Gil Scott Heron and his relationship to how did Malcolm X influence him, if you could answer that.
Well, I'm not sure about direct, but I can speak from a generational standpoint. Just first, as a footnote, the one time that I was closely working with Gil Scott Heron is when I chaired a major forum in Philadelphia as a fundraiser for John Africa and MOVE.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the headline person, and I was the MC.
Right.
So we were able to have some close conversation. But Gil Scott was a Pied Piper and a intellectual music maker for our movement. There is no one in our generation this morning who is not mourning the loss of Gil Scott Heron. It's a wonderful thing that you can go to YouTube and see so many videos of his entire career. And the thing that impressed me so much this morning as I was reviewing some of these videos is the fact that he was able to tell the truth even about the last years of his life. And that just is an amazing resource for us. Where he, when he was young, he was telling the truth. And when his body was ravaged by drugs and the defeat that this society has imposed on him, he still told the truth. And so that's a legacy. That's a gift to all of us. And so we should be proud that that he passed through.
You're listening to Saturday Morning Live. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and I'm on the line with Dr. Abdul Al-Kalimant. The number here is 416-595-1655. We're going to open up the phones in about 10 minutes, hopefully, and you can speak with Abdul Al-Kalimant. And now let's get to that hot potato, the Manning Marable book. Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. This book has caused quite a controversy, and I understand that I haven't read all of them, but you had like 100 reviews of the book you sent that out over the internet. What are your thoughts of the strengths and the weaknesses of the late Manning Marable's book?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that in our culture, it's hard to speak about somebody who has just passed. However, the book has received such a response that it's necessary to speak about the book. And I think this is the way to honor Manning Marable, is to take his book seriously. Now, the first thing I want to say about the book is its unique reception. I don't remember a book that has been so quickly reviewed in the major press of the ruling classes of the world. The Financial Times,
The Economist,
The Guardian of the UK, The Economist, Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, etc. They basically love this book. On the other hand, everyone who was close to Malcolm or who was close to the legacy of Malcolm in the Black Liberation Movement takes the opposite position. This ought to alert everybody that there are serious issues being raised. Now, one of the issues, just on the surface, is the poor scholarship of the book. Partly this is editing. As Herb Boyd points out, there are many, he says 25, many factual errors, even at the level of the date the NAACP was founded, that sort of thing. So they did not do a good job of fact-checking. And then secondly, I've been taking a hard look at the footnote, because it is alleged that this is a 20-year work of scholarship, a magnum opus. I have found, for example, that in all the footnotes, only about 20% are of primary sources, and 80% refer to already published works and the New York Times. Furthermore, there are specific statements that always have words in them like may have, maybe, some think that, and so most of these things have no footnotes. Again, the question of whether or not this is adequate scholarship. Now, one of the main themes throughout this book is sexuality. On the one hand, citing a book that has been pushed aside for many of the same reasons by Bruce Perry, that alleges that Malcolm was a homosexual. And this is not a question of what your position on homosexuality is. This is a question of scholarship and whether or not one is confident by spreading rumors, innuendo, and gossip to prove a point of a major historical importance. But then he goes beyond that to say that Malcolm was also a womanizer. And to suggest that the night before he was assassinated, he slept with a young 16 or 18-year-old girl. Again, based on the sentence, Sharon may have gone to the hotel. No evidence, no footnote. Then he goes beyond that to claim that Betty was running around with other men while Malcolm was alive, including Charles Kenyatta, or 37X. Again, with no evidence, but hearsay, and most of it coming from people who had a public position against Malcolm. So this sexuality thing is a well-known approach. This is what the CIA has in their playbook. Allende in Chile, they put that out on him. There's been a book on Paul Robeson. There's been a book on Nat Turner. There's been a book on Martin Luther King. And all of this is attacking at the sexual level in order to sort of cut them down from their iconic status. Mirabeau argues that this sexual theme humanizes Malcolm. Hello?
Yeah, I'm still listening. I'm listening intently.
Okay. Yeah. Humanizes Malcolm. And we believe that this was done to sell books opportunistically to serve Manning Marable.
Do you think that's coming from Manning, or is that coming from Viking Press, or do you have any idea where it's coming from?
Well, as I understand it, Manning offered this in his proposal to Viking,
mm-hmm.
so that he then got a six-figure advance. Now, this is what the conversation is in New York, and this is information I got from Herb Boyd.
Yeah, I did an interview with Herb, and he told me that was the same thing he told me. Correct, right.
So it's not a question of anybody forcing Marable to do these things. In fact, the staff that Marable had working at Columbia did produce a great deal of research, far beyond the research that shows up in this book. And I think that as the story comes out, we'll learn much more about this process. I know, for example, Marika Sherwood. She is a researcher who lives in London. She had come to New York early on, so she knew the U.S. scene and written several books. She followed Malcolm's experience in Africa and went there and dug up a lot of interesting material. She came to New York and spent 2 days with the research project at Columbia.
Right.
You see no mention of that in the book. You see no mention of Preston Wilcox in the book and so many others. Again, I regard this as intellectual dishonesty and poor scholarship. I have no idea why Manning put this book out this way. But actually, my criticism goes deeper than all of this, because I regard this as an anti-During moment. Now, During was a prominent academic in Germany.
Right.
And he wrote so many books alleging to be a socialist. And at a certain point, Engels, you know, basically said, Frederick Engels, the comrade of Karl Marx,
right.
Basically said, enough is enough, and wrote this book, which is the only real comprehensive book on philosophy and political economy of their collaboration. Because During had the image of being a prominent socialist. Now we have Manning Marable, who many believe as the leading Marxist theoretician of our movement. And so it's important to take up his work, not just this book, but all the books he wrote, and ask fundamental questions that get to the question of philosophy and political economy. Just give you one example. The book is titled A Life of Reinvention. And throughout the book, he portrays Malcolm sort of as an opportunist who was crafting his image and crafting his positions in order to curry favor with this one or that one. His position on Israel is alleged to be him currying favor with Nasser. And it did so many different things. In fact, this is a way of promoting an idealist philosophy, which says that you judge people by their consciousness and you can infer something by gathering together various positions that they've had. And the question is whether or not that is a Marxist position. As a materialist, we would look at the actual experience of Malcolm and to try to derive a logic in his life from that, because everybody knows that Malcolm went through various stages. But it wasn't that Malcolm just decided one day to craft a new identity. These were the historical forces that were working on him. Malcolm Little didn't decide to become Detroit Red. Those forces were imposed upon him, and then he found that as an avenue. And yet at the same time, the contradiction of the Detroit Red, that negation, led to a negation of the negation. Again, a fundamental principle of dialectics, where he had to, in prison, save himself, and that way was shown by his family and other people that he met. All the way to where Elijah Muhammad puts him in the context of the whole nation when he starts traveling. And suddenly Malcolm starts absorbing everything that's happening all around the country. And then the same thing happens when he, in the last stage of his life, he's absorbing everything from around the world. And in that sense, Malcolm became a leader showing us a path through these various dynamics, not because he was somehow having an out-of-body experience and transforming himself through ideas. These were material forces that were operating on his life, that they were operating on all of us. And that's really the point. So Marable comes off as a mechanical idealist and not a materialist. And he hides a lot of this in the muckraking journalism because he amasses so many facts. And in that instance, he becomes a mechanical materialist in the sense that, citing census data without an analysis of the dialectics of the situation, really is a way of hiding the kind of social democratic view that he was proposing throughout his life. In other words, I really think this is an anti-During moment for us, and so beyond this Malcolm book, we have to look at all of Malcolm, all of Manning Marable's work, to try to locate him. In other words, being in DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, sort of the left wing of the Democratic Party, that's a real political position that he held. And so we have to understand that there are philosophical issues here, there are deeper questions than simply the sloppy scholarship of the Malcolm X book.
You're listening to Saturday Morning Live. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. I'm on the line with Dr. Abdul Al-Kalimat, the author of many books and many projects around Malcolm X. Historically, I've always thought that Manning did some great work in terms of how was capitalism undeveloped, black America. He did some work around Medgar Evers. He did a lot of great work, but I know he was a democratic socialist. I think his first set of essays, he came out and basically said that he was a social democrat, and I know that he had a tendency to criticize people that were to the left of the democratic socialists. I don't know if he's ever criticized you in his writings, but anybody that he would consider a so-called Stalinist or would always get them. He would always have something harsh to say about them. But in terms of his other work, the Medgar Evers work and his work on Du Bois, how do you think that's going to hold up?
Oh, I think the critical question is what concepts or theoretical propositions has Marable contributed? I'm not in any way saying that none exist. It's just that I'd like to see somebody argue what they are. For example, Rickford, in the introduction to the Manning Marable Reader, does not go there at all. Rather, he describes the topics that Marable discusses, the books that he wrote, and so forth. Clearly, he was a very prolific writer, and was maybe will go down as an important journalist of this period. But in terms of theory, you take, for example, Walter Rodney's book. Rodney actually made fundamental contribution to theory about understanding the historical development of Africa. And his participation in the Dar es Salaam debates, along with Babu, stand today as the theoretical direction that the African Revolution can draw inspiration from. I'm not sure the same holds for Marable's book.
You're listening to Saturday Morning Live. We're going to open up the phones, 416-595-1655. 416-595-1655. If you wanted to speak with Abdul Al-Kalimat, we are discussing Malcolm X, El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, Omowale, and we're discussing Manning Marable's new book, and we're discussing a lot of the, you know, Malcolm X's legacy, and, you know, this whole question of this, the criticism I've been hearing of this book mostly is the whole thing about maybe, perhaps, coulda, woulda, shoulda type of thing. Everybody I talk to and listen to, that seems to be the a major criticism. You had something on you sent out. There was a debate, well, not a debate, but a big discussion in New York, which had Amina Baraka, Amiri Baraka, Bill Sales, William Strickland.
Yeah.
And somehow it got it was taken off of my, I don't know if there was something wrong with it. I saw most of it, but was there a problem with that?
There might be. I was able to see the entire 3 hours.
I saw maybe about 2.5 hours. Yeah, everything except
okay.
The question and answer period. But I couldn't get it back when I wanted to view it again, because Malcolm X's secretary, James 67 X Abdullah.
Yeah.
Razak. He is a very interesting gentleman. I guess he's disenchanted with the book.
Well, he alleges that on the one hand, he was interviewed by Marable extensively, but that the interview tapes were ignored and he was misrepresented in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So these are historical questions. So I'm hoping that this basic research information is made public so we can all take a look at it.
You're listening to Saturday Morning Live. The number here is 416-595-1655. We are on www.cklin.fm. And if you wanted to talk to Dr. Abdul Al-Kalimat, please call 416-595-1655. And you can talk to Abdul Al-Kalimat. This is Saturday Morning Live. And has there been any debates or discussions in Chicago around the book?
Well, everybody's talking about it. And the question is how to have a discussion that not only is about the book and Marable's work, but sets the stage for the kind of intellectual work and political practice that we need to have.
Pardon me, Abdul, but pardon me one second. The number here is, I give out the incorrect number. The number is 416-595-1478. 416-595-1478. Continue, please.
Yeah.
No, I said you can continue.
See, the main point is that this is an Obama moment, and we need the broadest possible front in order to attack or counterattack this new stage of imperialism led by black men, which has taken much of the wind out of the sails of our movement. And we have to reorganize because they could not do what they're doing without having someone like Obama
right.
in place. There would be a major national anti-war movement right now, and we don't have it. And so this book is part of the Obama moment. It's disorienting people. People like Manning, but they also like Malcolm. And that contradiction makes us inactive. And we have to forget about Manning Marable, and we have to forget about whatever sentiment we have toward Malcolm. The real question is, what would Malcolm do now? Just like what would Marable do now? And I think if people understood better what Malcolm would do, we might have the inspiration for more struggle.
Well, I understand that Manning is basically saying that Malcolm would have been a liberal. He would he was not really for this. Let's put it this way: a total transformation of American society. He was some way thinking, I guess, we could really vote our way into power. It looks like that's some of the conclusions that he draws in the book, if I'm not mistaken.
Manning is turning Malcolm toward Obama. In other words, the Ballad of the Bullet speech, Marable totally misunderstands the fundamental critique of state power that's in that speech. I'd just like to say that if people go to brothermalcolm.net, they will see what we call the Detroit speeches, the Message to the Grassroots,
mm-hmm.
Ballad of the Bullet, and
Last Message.
What people call the Final Message.
Yeah, right.
Those three speeches will give you a snapshot of Malcolm's philosophy and understanding of the world. How anybody could say that Malcolm would have become a cheerleader for Obama is beyond reason.
Pardon me, the number here is 416-595-1478, 416-595-1478. And I remember General Gordon Baker. I was living in his house at the particular time, and we were listening to the message, not message, the Ballad of the Bullet. And Malcolm was talking about General Motors didn't start up as a big operation. They started out as a little mom and pa type of situation. And he talked about General Motors becoming taking some of everybody's money. And I remember General booing that particular speech. And at that particular time, I was like 20, 21 years old. And that was really the first time I heard anybody, basically come out and criticize Malcolm, because I guess, because Malcolm was basically talking at that time, he was still in the Nation of Islam, and he was talking about a sort of a black capitalist type of situation. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that I found, that many of us grew to be able to criticize Malcolm, because we understood that he left the Nation of Islam because he was basically telling us that, look, I am not perfect. I make mistakes, and I'm a human being. Whereas in his previous life, he talked about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad as being chosen by God. But we grew to love Malcolm because he basically says that, I'm one person, I have one vote. We should have a collective leadership that should include men and women. That was basically what I got out of Malcolm. And Manning is trying to say that he wants to humanize Malcolm. But I think many of us who followed Malcolm have already made the humanization argument already. Or do you agree with that?
Yeah. I want to say something about Elijah Muhammad. I actually had the opportunity to spend an evening with Elijah Muhammad
mm-hmm.
when I was chairperson of SNCC in Chicago.
Right.
because he was trying to reach out to all the members of the movement. And one of the things he said that really impressed me, he said, before I die, I would like to see black people own their own community.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you put that together with the small entrepreneurial activity that they were promoting, and compare that to the inner city black community today.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody in my neighborhood in Chicago said, we're going to open a grocery store, everybody would applaud.
Right.
There ain't no grocery stores in my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
There's no place to get a prescription filled. And so you got to get on the bus and go somewhere else to shop. And so we have to understand that the survival of people is an essential part of the struggle. So that one of the things that really turns me off is when people assume that Elijah Muhammad was stupid, a silly old man.
Right, right.
And take, for example, the cosmology and the, like him talking about
Yaqub,
devils and demons.
Right.
And talking about the mothership and talking about Yaqub. Now, if you take Yaqub and what he says about that, and think that you're reading Dante and the imagery to educate people, and put that next to the scientific discussion of the Neanderthal, and you might learn something. In other words, he was trying to speak in terms that would convey a message and under no circumstances would draw the wrath of the authorities. Now, I'm not saying that I agree with everything Elijah Muhammad said, but I give him credit for being a rational and important thinker in the history of our struggle. And I think that one of the things that Marable does is what most white people do is want to make fun and cast him aside. Malcolm was in the Nation and learned from the Nation most of his adult life. And so we can't separate Malcolm from the Nation. On the other hand, in the Black Liberation Movement, one of the wonderful things is that everybody was subject to criticism. And whether it was Malcolm or anybody else, in wherever he went, there would be people arguing with him about different things. Compare that to the public intellectuals today who have such thin skin, they're supposed to be above criticism. So Malcolm was one of us. And people would beat on Malcolm and they would see him change his ideas. And that came from the nationalist tradition in Harlem. It came from the working class traditions. It came out of Cleveland and Detroit. And, of course, his international travel was really the final stage of all of it.
You're listening to Saturday Morning Live. The number here is 416-595-1478. We are on the line with Abdul Al-Kalimat. And the Nation of Islam had a newspaper, Muhammad Speaks, and there's, I guess, many people say that Malcolm put it together in the initial stages. I've always thought it was Malcolm put it together. Some people are trying to dispute that now. But the I used to read this guy by the name of Charles P. Howard, and I remember
yes.
Elijah Muhammad had a column, middle page, and he would give his ideas, and he'd have a section, How to Eat to Live. But a lot of the stuff in there was, I remember seeing Ben Bella from Algeria's picture in there. I remember seeing Nkrumah. I remember seeing Gamal Abdul Nasser.
Here's what people don't know. Elijah Muhammad was so slick he always had a pro-socialist or communist or revolutionary editor. And I'd just like to mention two names. One is Richard Durham.
Right.
And the other is John Woodford.
Right.
Now, both of them kept the pages of the Muhammad Speaks right on point in terms of the world revolutionary struggle. And the movement read Muhammad Speaks because during the Vietnam War, we were reading the news dispatches that were coming out of Hanoi. We were reading about news dispatches that were coming out of Havana. This was global clarity that Muhammad Speaks would provide. And then, of course, there would be the columns directed specifically toward the nation, but also of relevance. For example, there was a great emphasis on how to eat to live. This was a fabulous thing. There was all kinds of stuff on how to live otherwise, social behavior and so on. And then, of course, the centerfold, which was his editorial about the mothership or about other issues. And this is a form of writing, I think, that requires literary analysis and not superficial, simplistic analysis.
You're listening to Saturday Morning Live, and I was approached by the CBC when the Spike Lee film Malcolm X came on, and they interviewed me for about 2 hours, and basically what I found out was basically they wanted me to attack Elijah Muhammad, which I refused to attack them the way they wanted me to attack him. I was basically saying that I believe Malcolm X. I'm a secular person, and Malcolm talked about one being a secular person. Well, that was the Organization of Afro-American Unity, as well as the Muslim Mosque Incorporated was his religious group. And Elijah Muhammad was a bourgeois nationalist in the sense that he was talking about he didn't really want to deal with the whole question of capitalism. Now, maybe he knew something that we didn't know. Maybe he didn't want to go to jail. Well, he went to jail already. But they wanted me basically to talk about Elijah, to criticize him completely, which I refused to do. And I think Elijah Muhammad, brought I think it was a lot of people came through Elijah Muhammad who never really joined the nation because they basically, like Huey Newton, Bobby Seale, Stokely Carmichael, people like that.
Sure, we were in a movement.
Right.
Not just in organizations.
Right. Is there anything else you would like to add? I think we're running out of time.
Okay, well, the main thing is that I'd like your readers to take this debate around the Marable book beyond the book. Because Elijah Muhammad wrote a book, How to Eat to Live. We need to start talking about how to think to live. And when it comes to scholarship, we need proof. And we need to follow the revolutionary guideline, no investigation.
No right to speak.
No right to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate so much being on this program.
All right. And I would like to thank you, and we will probably be back in touch with you sooner than later.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. We have been speaking with Abdullah Kalimat, and we have been talking about his projects around Malcolm X and the new book by Manny Marable on